David McCullough is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. We were talking about slavery starting at the very beginning. And again, the similarity with Truman, where he has to confront the experience of the African American. One of the things, and I don't know if this fits or not, but for me, Adam's great concern is about a time and a place, and slavery is right in that mix from the first day. And yet it is Jefferson who gets the credit for having the vision, where it's Adams who has articulated these things. It's Jefferson of whom Adams says, I worry about aristocracy, you worry about monarchy. These are big differences.
Very big differences, and it's important to understand that Adams was willing to put aside the issue of slavery in order to achieve independence, in order to achieve union. And you see the same theme repeated in Lincoln's time. Lincoln said, you know, I'm here to save the Union. I'm not here to free slaves. If, as it turned out, by freeing the Union, he can free the slaves, fine. Or by freeing the slaves, if he increases the chances of preserving the Union, that's fine. But the New Englanders had enough trouble as it was to get the South to come in and get the middle states to come in into the war. The New Englanders, were already fighting. That's what's important. And when Jefferson talks about Virginia as my country, you know, when he says my country, he's talking about Virginia. He's not talking about the United States of America. It doesn't exist yet. When Adams talks about my country, he's talking about Massachusetts. And one of the great strokes of Adams' genius was to put in nomination George Washington to be the commander of the Continental Army.
Who is a Virginian.
Who is a Virginian and a slaveholder. And George Washington, who was by far the best choice to command the army, comes to New England to command what is still a New England army. It isn't a Continental Army. It's George Washington that makes it sort of, you know, gives it, again, balance, geographic balance. And
we've forgotten that it is those big slaveholding states where all the wealth of the colonies were.
All the wealth
and
all the power, all the political power. Virginia was the most populous, wealthiest, politically powerful state, colony among all the colonies, and state after we achieved independence, by far.
And couldn't be ignored.
By far, could not be ignored. It was the California of then and then some. And so, you know, people say, well, why do we have all these Virginians as presidents for so long? Well, that's the answer.
Part of what I found striking, again, in both your books on John Adams and Harry Truman, is how ugly politics is and how necessary.
And
the willingness of a John Adams and in a very different way, Harry Truman, to get up to their elbows in it and make those compromises, compromising core principles. And it's always easy to sit back on the sidelines and say, well, I would never do that. But the reality is something had to be done, and the willingness of these people to step up to that and to deal with the discomfort and the insults and all the other that went around that, and the frustrations.
Which have been there from day one.
And the sense of, in some sense, you know, the sense of compromise, but in some sense, in Adams, you can see it now and again, the sense of, in a way, it's our phrase now, of having sold out by virtue of doing that.
Well, Harry Truman, of course, was a machine politician.
Absolutely.
He was the essence of what Adams didn't want to be.
Absolutely. And sectarian.
Yeah, Adams is an independent.
Party politics.
And his fierce independence is both his greatest strength and his greatest weakness. Harry Truman rose because he was a party politician. John Adams rose in spite of not being a party politician.
And in fact, parties hadn't yet kind of happened Adams' time.
But he was aggressively opposed to the notion of partisan politics.
Oh, he thought parties, as did Washington, thought that parties were going to be the poison of the whole process.
As did Jefferson, but
but he didn't. he said it.
He was very good.
He said it, but he was very good behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Adams thought that if you have, as did others, particularly Washington, if you have political parties, the members of the political parties would soon begin to take the fortunes and future of the party more to heart than the fortunes and future of the nation.
And he was right.
And he was right.
I also had
However.
The sense with both of these men that there really were forces of, this is prejudicial and I accept it, forces of evil that wanted to keep people from having this liberty of which they, to which they were so committed, that there were big forces that wanted this not to happen, that it was true in the time of Adams and Jefferson, at the time of the Revolution, and it's been true always, that there are big forces at work here. And it's not obvious what the outcome will be.
But what do you mean by that?
Well, I'm thinking of the... it's Truman who articulates so well the dichotomy between the special interests, as he calls them. Well, all the way through these times of which you speak, you can see I can see Adams, as he says, I'm afraid of the aristocracies. There are natural aristocracies. They will come to the fore. They will rule us given the opportunity. And it doesn't change for 200 years.
And his solution was to pen them up in the Senate.
I found that surprising.
And it almost worked.
And now you see we have a senator who spent $60 million to get elected from New Jersey.
Yeah.
We have, it's Millionaire's Row there. It's exactly what Adams was talking about.
So again, tensions between just lots of people, and that base has grown in those years to include women and people of color and people who are not landed. But this tension between really having a government of the people and having a government that serves particular interests doesn't seem to have changed at all.
Adams' popularity was never great in his time. It was greater than many people believe it to have been. After all, he was elected president. And he very nearly was reelected president. Very close election. People imagine that Jefferson was swept into office by a great wave of lowercase Democratic popularity, but not so. But Adams never courted popularity, and he didn't like politicians who pandered to the mob. However, part of his lack of popularity was because he told people then things that they didn't want to hear. Jefferson is much more diplomatic, much more evangelical in telling us what we love to hear. We loved it. We love optimism. We are an optimistic people. Jefferson is telling us that everything is going to get better. We're going to rise higher. Man is perfectible. Look to the West. You know, it's a wonderfully American creed. Adams is saying, you know, we're human beings, and we're not really any better than other people are elsewhere in the world. We have the blessing of a better form of government. We have the huge advantage of the Atlantic Ocean separating us from all the troubles of Europe. And we have riches in our natural resources beyond the imagining of any people ever. But as human beings, we're as prey to sin and failures, incompetence, all the rest, as any people are. And furthermore, if we don't take this treasure of our way of life seriously, we can blow it. We can ruin it. So, he's saying, yes, we do have freedom. Yes, we do believe in freedom. But with freedom goes responsibility. And it calls for truthfulness, hard work, and participation in the system. And those poignant, beautiful letters of Abigail's where she talks about, oh, what happened to my untitled man? That man I fell in love with who didn't have a great role to play, who wasn't burdened with the responsibilities of government and statesmanship and all that. And oh, how I've suffered because he is now a titled man. But she knows he has to do it. It's part of the ethic, part of the code. And that great summons to march that she gives him when he's in Philadelphia. She said, I know you would not want to be an idle spectator, and I would not have you one. We have too many high-sounding words and too few actions to correspond with them. And that's, in many ways, to me, the key to their lives. Actions do speak louder than words. Adams very nearly always practices what he preaches. If he's going to preach service to the country, he's going to serve. if he's going to preach that nothing really comes without a measure of pain, he's going to do those things which call for a measure of pain.
In a sense, that's the genius of which you speak, his ability to think great thoughts, develop great theories, his constitutions, but to do that with a keen understanding of what the implications, the applied results are going to be of this, which goes well beyond the high-sounding words. It is high-sounding words predicated on an understanding of what the implications are, the real implications are.
And he's there when you need him. He's there when he's not a summer soldier. You know, the fact that I start the story, the book, with him setting off on that ride to Philadelphia in the dead of winter is for me a metaphor of what is all of what's to follow. That it's inconvenient, it's uncomfortable, it's not what he would wish for. He has to leave his family. He's got this difficult journey to make. And the book, the story, is a journey. It's a journey, an outward journey and an inward journey. And it's after he comes back from the presidency, after he comes home, this man who has traveled farther in the service of his country than anybody of his time, comes home to Quincy, Massachusetts, and never goes anywhere again for 25 years. But the inward journey then really kicks in. And he suffers all those horrible losses, the agony of his daughter's death, the loss of his son to alcoholism, the decline of his other son from alcoholism. And then, of course, the worst blow of all is the death of Abigail. And still at the end, the old love of life, the old fire upstairs, back of the eyes and between the ears, is blazing. And that beautiful, beautiful piece he writes about seeing the trees after an ice storm. The ice storm that's destroyed his beloved trees, and he finds it more exquisite than the most magnificent chandelier or Marie Antoinette with all her diamonds. He's seen me, Marie Antoinette. This isn't just
this isn't speculation.
Yeah, he's known the most brilliant people of his age. He's been to Paris, London. He's
Amsterdam. Very important.
Amsterdam nearly dies in Amsterdam trying to get those loans. What a story.
The story is of John Adams. It's being told by David McCullen. We're all going to be back with the Paula Gordon Show in just a moment.